Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast that exists to remind you that this world is full of mystery, magic, and sometimes mayhem. I source intrepid guests with stories of near-death experiences, ghosts and visions, and paranormal encounters that can't be explained. And this time is no exception. I'm introducing you to Dr. Raymond Roberts, who is a pastor with 40-plus years of experience. He's an author, and he's also an incredible musician. But who am I to describe Dr. Raymond? I'll let him introduce himself in his own words, and just wait till you hear his miracle story. It brought him to tears, and frankly, me too. It's a powerful reminder of connection, synchronicity, and how this world works in incredibly mysterious ways. All right, let's get to it. Here's my conversation with the incredible Dr. Raymond Roberts.
The clerk of session, a woman said, and then the clerk of session, the session is the group that governs the church. She said, "Are we ready to start?" And I said, "I think we are." And she walks out. She says, "Boys, y'all come in." And so they're all standing around outside. They start walking in, and lightning struck the oak tree that they were under, blew out a window in the church. And it was this remarkable, like, and the tree lived. But it was wow. Roberts. I identify as a Christian, Presbyterian in that tradition. So it's a particular tradition. It's PCUSA, which is the liberal tradition within the Presbyterian family, Reformed family. I am an American. Grew up here. I'm a Midwesterner. I'm from Missouri. And that's how I pronounce it. Not like everybody else. Everybody else is wrong. But I'm from Missouri. I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan. I'm a Boy Scout. And that was very formative for who I am. And so that's a neat little summary. I've been 40 years a pastor, and I do have a PhD in history and theology.
Cool. I'm loving what you've just told me, because I have questions here. So years ago, when I subscribed to Smithsonian Magazine, they did this gorgeous article. It was just so beautiful. And it was about a really fabulous kind of summer, I would say. I don't know if it was a summer. Well, it was best during the summer, I guess. But it was following a road along Missouri for music and all the festivals and musical jazz, blues. And that Missouri was known for having all of these incredible events that really honored the history of the music, the mm-hmm. people of the music, along with a whole lot of amazing food and celebration and community gathering. Is this true, or is it? Am I making this up? I can't tell.
You know, I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you. I know there's, you know, like there's the, in St. Genevieve, you've got this French influence that's there. So that's a part of the Missouri tradition. And then there's also, you know, St. Louis blues, you know, and yes. the northern migration out of the South by African-Americans to northern cities to escape discrimination and to get jobs and stuff. But yeah, my mother was a classically trained pianist. And was really quite a good pianist. I didn't realize she was such a good pianist until I was much, much older. I just thought everybody got tucked to bed, and if their mother played piano, they played like my mother did while we went to sleep. You know, Chopin, Mendelssohn, concertos, and different things. I just thought that's life. So my family was very focused on classical music. That was the only real music. And I was they gave me violin lessons when I was a kid. And those were fine until I got old enough to think that is the nerdiest thing. My parents hate me. They want to punish me. So I taught myself guitar. And of course, now I'm in a band called Reckless and Wild. We're on Spotify. So and then now that I'm older, I look back on that experience and think, yeah, it's pretty good training for, you know, creating and writing music, which is one of the things I love to do.
Amazing. Can I ask you, when you were growing up, did you have a favorite kind of music?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends on which age. Until I got to high school, I remember when the Beatles came out and they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. So I'm that old. They were on the Ed Sullivan Show and all my friends were talking about the Beatles. And then, my family was not a popular music family. You know, we were listening to, Dvorak and Brahms. And we weren't listening to that stuff. And so I was really interested in it. My mother said, "Oh, that's really not music." And then my father, I remember at a party at our house, we used to have these dinner parties and friends would come over. My parents' friends would come over. And my father pontificating that the Beatles music was pretty good if you took out the rock element. It's kind of like that's how liberal he was. So, I have a cousin, Tommy Johnson, who was in a band called the Doobie Brothers. And my aunt says that he wrote, listen to the music play at my grandmother's house down the street. And but he was I know my mother just was like, you know, she as I got to high school, music's a fine avocation, but it's no way to make a living. So she was trying to get me away from music because I was so interested in it.
Okay, all of that is amazing. Just, you know, learning instruments for me is a practical impossibility. Do you think you have an affinity for?
I think I was exposed to it as a very young child.
Okay.
And I was, you know, a guy named Dan Peake, who was in the band America, grew up behind my grandmother's house before he moved to England. And I used to walk his sister home from school and carry her books, Becky Peake. And there was music around. And so that was always a big part of my life. I tend to, you know, there may be some aptitude. I'm sure there's some aptitude, right? We come into this life with genetic predispositions and that can be developed in certain ways. But so I'm certain there's something there for which I'm grateful. But I also think, you know, they say everybody in China can carry a tune because Chinese language is so tuneful.
You know? Yeah. Ma? I actually read a real. Yeah. No, you're right.
I mean, that's all three different words.
Yeah. I know. I actually read a really fascinating article that because of that, 90% of people over there have perfect pitch, and which is incredibly rare in the rest of the world, but it's because it's a tonal language. And I thought that is so fascinating. God.
Yeah, well, it goes to show how much we're shaped by our environment. There's the nature, but then there's the nurture.
Yeah.
And I got lucky on the nurture side of things.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's honestly, hope
for- oh yeah. Oh yeah. I think, you know, I'm thinking about your grandmother's house and it sounds like the house was in the perfect place and what a great environment. You could walk your friend home with her books and come home and be surrounded by music. And I think it's a special kind of brain that is able to learn music, but learn instruments. You know, my father rented a piano for me when I was younger and I just thought I mean, I already know I'm being set up for failure accidentally, but then I've met other people who just, it is seamless for them. It is easy. They're able to do it without, you know, I love this question. When you were a little boy, What did you dream of becoming?
Oh, well, in my family, I dreamt of becoming a lawyer or a doctor. Those were the two things. And my father was an attorney. He was a prosecuting attorney right out of law school. And then he was the small town lawyer, which did everything from probate to criminal law. And then he got into labor arbitration and arbitrated all over the country. He had a little private plane and would fly to Tumwa, Iowa, or, the Kentucky coal fields or in different places arbitrating between labor and management. And he would take me with him. I was the eldest son. And looking back on it, I didn't see it at the time. I mean, you know, you're kind of clueless growing up, right? But he was grooming me for the profession. And when I told him that I wanted to go into ministry, he looked at me and said, "You're making a very bad financial mistake." And he wasn't wrong. He wasn't wrong. But, there's more to life than money. And I think that's the other thing my family taught me is that maybe that wasn't the lesson they wanted to teach me because anybody that's flying around the world or flying to Mexico in February to go bass fishing and writing a letter to the school about how this is going to be some sort of cross-cultural experience for their son. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, we had a house in the Bahamas when I was a kid, and we had a lot of things, but what we didn't have is a spiritual life. Or I somehow along the way, with all this enriched life, there was a spiritual emptiness in the middle of it. Okay. What am I here for? What's my purpose in life? What about those who don't live like I do and whose moms have to get up and work in the Trimfoot factory across town and they come home and they're tired and, you know, when they tell the kids to go to sleep and they don't own a piano. That sense of what is this all about? Those questions were really big in my mind.
Wow. So. I kind of just thank you for sharing your childhood because that does sound very enriching, frankly. And your father just sounds really driven, motivated, you know, passionate about what he did, but also what a gift. I mean, I know that he was kind of like saying, "Hey, you know, maybe this is what you could do later," but what a gift to be exposed to all these different places mm-hmm. around the States at that time and all the different people, because, you know, plenty of fathers wouldn't have taken any of their children. They would have just.
And we would talk about the cases.
Wow.
And on the way there and on the way back. And my father had a sense of justice that was pretty strong. And that, you know, he, I think that's what made him such a successful labor arbitrator, is that sense of justice, but also recognition of the rule of law. I mean, you know, I would say, "Well, I think it should be this." And he said, "Well, the contract says this. So what do you say now?" And, I have a sense of that.
Yeah.
That I've brought into how I look at the world.
Yeah. Wow. You know, you've segued really nicely into the second question, which was, and you've kind of already alluded to part of the answer, but, you know, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like? It sounds like not. And then, you know, how did your connection evolve over time with the divine so that now, you know, then you chose ministry? That's pretty fascinating.
In some ways, my family was religious in that they sent me to a Lutheran grade school. And that was partly because my mom had been a French teacher at the local high school and the principal said "ain't" and didn't use good grammar and she was not impressed. And so she was being the Wellesley grad here in Little Farmington, Missouri. She didn't like that. So sent me to the Missouri Synod Lutheran grade school. And she once told me that, I didn't believe in God when I graduated from college, but then when you were born, When I was carrying you, I thought to myself, well, I wouldn't believe in me if I were the baby growing in, you know. And so she said that gave me a sense of maybe there is the possibility of something bigger than us that we're a part of. So I've never really had much trouble believing that there is a God. And at the Lutheran grade school, I remember Mrs. Schramm once saying, well, go to the zoo and look at the monkeys and you can wait there all your life and then not a single one of them will turn into a human being. And, you know, she was speaking against evolution. So I went home and talked to my mom about this. She goes, we believe in evolution. You don't have to make a big deal about it with your students at the school, but we believe in evolution. So I've never understood why people have trouble with the idea that God can use secondary sources. St. Augustine called it the seed principle. But we weren't active in going to church except for the time when I was in the Lutheran grade school. And in fact, when my father died, I learned that he'd been an elder in the Presbyterian Church. I didn't know that. I knew he was fond of the Presbyterian minister who had, I think he might have baptized me. I was baptized in the Presbyterian Church. I went through confirmation in the first. We weren't active. We didn't go. You know, our family could have done so much for that church. Once you become a pastor, you kind of realize, you know, we that church could have really benefited from, you know, the resources and the presence if we'd kind of looked beyond ourselves. What we did is most weeks is we'd sit at home, cook eggs and bacon, spend time together reading the newspaper, drink coffee, and maybe work in the yard. Or if we weren't doing that, we would go floating on the rivers of that part of Missouri, which is known for all of its, you know, the Current River, the Black River, the Merrimack, the Mineral Fork, you know, 11 Point, all these different rivers.
Sorry, but it sounds like you're describing heaven.
It was pretty great. And but we weren't ever in church. We didn't even go on Christmas and Easter. My grandmother was quite devout. She was very involved in the Methodist Church. And it was a Boy Scout leader. My Boy Scout master once asked me, would you be the troop chaplain? And that was a providential question. And I'd never considered it. But I didn't know how to say no. And so I agreed to lead a kind of worship service on our Boy Scout camping trips. And I thought, you know, I don't know anything about this except for what I learned in the Lutheran school for 3 years from kindergarten to second grade. I should go back to church. So I started going to church, going to Sunday school, met my friends, and the kids in MYF became my friends. And I would go to MYF. And when I was in high school, I'd go to church by myself. My grandmother would sit down. I'd see her. I'd sit in the balcony with the kids, and she'd sit on, you know, she'd be down on the floor. And if some of my friends weren't there, I'd sometimes sit with her. But it was kind of around the church. My father was pretty skeptical of organized religion, I would say. He was, you know, kind of with a Mark Twain kind of sense of, which that stuck with me too. you see people who are religious do a lot of foolish things in the name of religion, inspired by the faith. You know, that especially in our time, I think we see stuff that I think is going to be hard for the church in the future. You know, it's not a good witness.
I think it's really interesting for the Anglican Communion. You know, when I was in seminary, I had a class that was dedicated just to the history of the Anglican Communion and, you know, from, you know, their origination to the present. And it was really interesting understanding that, as with all things, you know, things evolve, they change, they shift, they orient themselves in new ways to what's right, going on in the world, and how do the human beings within those organizations, I don't know, I guess live their truth or respond in a way that feels authentic to them and with integrity. And I just, you know, I'm a panentheist, so I have no skin in what's going on. But certainly all of my, I went to a Methodist seminary, very liberal Methodist seminary. And so certainly the rest of my cohort was, you know, kind of starting to engage with these issues. And it'll be interesting to see what happens over time.
There's no sinless traditions. And that's something my dissertation advisor, Doug Ottotti, taught me. I don't know if you know Doug Ottotti. He just retired from teaching at Davidson, but he was my doctoral dissertation advisor. But he would say there are no sinless traditions, and that includes the Christian traditions.
Yeah.
And that includes national traditions. You know, I mean, there's, I think in our time, a desire to expunge from the record the idea of the, of America's founding faults. And, you know, that's, and it's problematic because faults shape the way we're living today.
Yeah. If we didn't make mistakes, how would we ever learn?
Yeah. On the other hand, but I, from my understanding, since more than just mistakes,
that's true. That's true.
It's not, oh, I blew it. It's more like someone's really getting hammered because of this, the way the sin I've either done or we've organized to do.
Thank you. Thank you. I am intrigued by the answer to this question. You know, your father sounds like he really, well, your whole family, it sounds like a life of the mind, very intelligent, very compassionate, but also oriented outwards to the world. You know, it wasn't an insular household facing inward. Your father absolutely, you know, flying all over the country for his job and his work, negotiating, helping, being of service, you know, I can't even imagine what that example kind of showed you or how it led you. Do you feel like his work and witnessing his work has led you to some of the work that you've done today? I mean, you are a, I want to ask you about this. You're a professor of health ethics and, or you were a professor of health ethics. Well, I don't even know what that is. I'd love to hear what that means, but it does seem like a little bit of a, I don't know, I don't want to say social justice, but helping people understand how to be in the world around health in a way that has integrity and, you know, authenticity, but also wholeness and a healthy way to engage with ethics around health.
Yeah, I'm not teaching this semester, but when I've taught it, it's, you know, I talk about the ethics of being a professional, because that, you know, as a professional, like you're educated, you know, you're tested against a body of knowledge. I mean, that's hence the professing part of professional. It's emphasis upon that. The classic professions, of course, law, medicine, ministry, education. You know, it's not just professional dry cleaning. Right. and it's oriented around the university. And so you know, the stuff I've read about the, you know, being a professional gives you a sense of responsibility. Right. If you're an engineer and you've passed the engineering, you have a what your job is to kind of help people deal with the natural world. You know, the forces of nature. And or if you're a, you know, of course, medicine's about health, law's about legal, and ministry is about our relationship with the divine. So I would start the class there. And then I really wanted to give them a method of moral analysis and help give them tools for thinking through what are the dynamics that are going on that we need to pay attention to. And so I taught a form of not only ethics, what is ethics, you know, deontological ethics, teleological ethics, virtue ethics, but also a way of analyzing situations. Almost every ethical argument is couched in a couple terms. One is there's some understanding of the situation. There are moral norms, and then there are loyalties that are being served. Mm. So, like in health, you know, someone may choose a course of action to protect that. I'm going to practice defensive medicine so I don't get sued. They may want to do a scientific experiment, advance science. They may want to keep the patient alive for the family. They may want to serve the patient first. I mean, there are a number of loyalties that can compete. And then finally, and I think the hardest for the students to grasp is that moral arguments are always shaped by anthropological assumptions. Who are people? What do they need to flourish? How can we expect them to react? So anyway, I tried to give them that's a brief parameter. That's the whole class. Could have just done it in 5 minutes.
Thank you for that explanation, because I saw that. I was like, health ethics, interesting. You know, I've interviewed multiple people whose parents were really involved in making life better in whatever way they could for others. You know, I do see some of that in your work. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as a, you know, it says that you're a historian pastor, but you're also, you know, you are, I would say, a historian, you know, as well. And we always need people who can step outside of history and observe it objectively. However, I just read another article that said nothing in this world can be objective because we're all observing it through our lens. So literally everything's subjective. It doesn't matter what you're looking at. But as best we can, observing, you know, history, kind of stepping out of it, and seeing what's going on today in the world. You know, it's a little overwhelming what's going on in the United States. You know, I also am kind of colored by the fact that I grew up in an Islamic country for 4 years. So I've actually have deep intimacy with people overseas. Oh, Pakistan.
Pakistan.
Yeah. And so I understand, you know, that we have way more in common than anything else. But it is interesting it's not interesting. For me, it's dismaying to see whole cultures kind of demonized, vilified, painted with a very, very broad brush. There's no nuance. There's no, you know, often these comments or disparagements are made in complete ignorance. No, the people haven't even met anyone who is a practitioner of Islam or Hinduism or whatever the case may be. And, you know, call me simplistic. That's fine. I will accept that. But I really like it when everybody gets together and gets to learn from each other. I think that's how our culture, our world, our society becomes richer and more beautiful. But here you are with, you know, kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're observing what's going on. You know history. You are aware of the nuances, the ebbs and flows of different ideas. How do you feel about what's going on now? And this is such a big question, and I'm sorry to kind of like foist it on you. But, you know, if you have, you know, kind of a little contribution about, you know, what you think is going on in the U.S., I'd love to hear it.
There's a really good book, although I don't disagree with the last chapter. It's called Fall of Republics. And he makes the case that it looks at republics in history. And it talks about Sparta, Carthage, Rome, Venice. Then it looks at what the lessons were that people learned from these republics for the political development of that happened in England during the English Civil War and also in the American Revolution. And one of the things he says is that the other republics, contrary to Benjamin Franklin's statement, it's a republic if you can keep it, which makes it kind of sound like a fragile teacup, actually are pretty resilient. They're more resilient than dictatorships, which can only last as long as the dictator. But what he says, the only republic that fell in history is Rome, and it fell once it had no external enemies. And so the fear of the external enemy was turned, and he says, in any large political body, you're going to get parties, usually two parties, because you can't get power unless you've got two parties and become the majority. And so it's usually two parties. And this fear that had been directed outward And you know, we all know there's all kinds of terrible things that happen with fear directed outward, but becomes directed inward. And that's what created the dysfunction that led to the fall of the Roman Republic. And I think we see that going on. I think we're deeply polarized, and it's not just it's affective polarization is what they call it. You know, it's our problem's not the principles, because apparently people are willing to sacrifice principles pretty easily. It's not even the policies, because people seem pretty flexible about the policies, frankly. You know, some constitutional conservatives are suddenly, you know, well, it broke the law, it doesn't matter. Or they excuse it with whataboutism, or they, you know, our problem becomes with the other party and the other people. And the fear is that if they take power, things will get really bad. Well, it doesn't mean they won't get bad, because, you know, there's some people espousing some pretty scary stuff. But it doesn't mean everybody does. And what happens is the middle hollows out of a republic. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. It's and people pick the worst examples of the other party to say everybody thinks that way. And healthy parties police themselves. And right now it appears to me that one of the parties is unable to police itself. Todd Blanch be the latest example, where you've got a clearly unfit person who has weaponized and will weaponize the government in ways, a dangerous person. And yet the person on the committee says, there's nothing we can do. You know, well, you've got to vote. The Constitution gave Article 1 first it's Article 1 for a reason. And it has to do with Congress and the role of Congress. Article 2 has to do with the executive. And I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and there are all kinds of reforms they talked about on the presidency that we need to make, reforming emergency powers, pardon powers, and other things. But then there was a person who used to be Marco Rubio's legal advisor, who's head of what is it called? It doesn't matter. He's the head of a group. He said, you know, we've talked a lot about the problems in the presidency, but our real problems in Congress, because Congress has a role and it's not playing the role that the founders envisioned. And the real problem with that is cultural. It's cultural. That is, our culture is not able to hold our representative. And there's a variety, you know, gerrymandering and other things. But there's a variety of reasons that the Congress is not fulfilling its role. And, this is Greg Nunzia, I believe is his name, Society for the Rule of Law. He said the founders foresaw lots of different parties, but I'm not sure they really saw two parties. And so, you know, how do you speak? What there are ways to speak more objectively about this, but anytime you speak, you become part of the continuum, and so you're immediately pegged as, oh, well, you're for this side, not the other side. And when party identities is so central to people's identity, you may have noticed when I introduced myself, I didn't say I'm a, because in many ways, I probably vote one way or another. You probably guess what it is, but I'm much more interested in principles and the person and the policy, you know, the candidate and the policies than I am with, I'm going to vote my party. That never crosses my mind. In fact, it just doesn't.
Thank you so much for that answer. It's really helpful for me. Because sometimes I get overwhelmed by everything that's going on, and I just wonder, how does a person take it all in and kind of understand it, or even begin to understand it, or when there's so much happening all the time, it's just really hard to keep up. And thank you. That is very helpful, and I'm so grateful to hear your point of view.
The Apostle Paul said, our struggle is not with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers. And I need to write this up, but this would be maybe the next book. But I do think it is so easy to think people are the problem. And sometimes they are problematic. I just mentioned Todd Blanche. He's a problem. But our bigger problem is what's driving the behavior of people in ways, the amount of money in politics, the way our media system is set up, the way we get our information. I mean, there's other things that are, and I would also say the decline of the mainline church, I think is a part of this. We no longer share a language that helps us to, and the mainline church at its best, not always at its best, but at its best, gave a language that was not exclusionary. It didn't exclude other voices, but it gave you a reason to include them. If you look at somebody like John Witherspoon, who's the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence, he leads the Presbyterian Church to demand. First thing they pass when they organize the national church is God alone is Lord of the conscience, and changes the Westminster Confession of Faith, to say from the magistrate's supposed to uphold true religion to the magistrate's supposed to treat everybody the same. They did a number of things at the very beginning. Those are the first things he did about freedom of religion. And of course, his most famous student is James Madison, who helps with the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, Memorial and Remonstrance Against State Taxation to Pay for Clergy Salaries, and writes the First Amendment. I mean, that's his most famous student. And he's echoing these ideas of freedom. And those are good reasons, I would argue Christians have very good reasons to uphold the freedom of Muslims to live as Muslims in American society, and not be afraid of them being taking office and winning office. The idea of natural law, for example, Paul says in Romans chapter 2, God has given everyone a conscience. Well, if everyone has a moral sensibility, that means that there are no religious tests for office.
Yeah.
And it leads directly to that.
Yeah. I actually, years ago, read an incredible book on a pope who lived around the year 1000. And he was very tolerant, very open, didn't last very long, but was very tolerant and very open. And because of that, there was a great flowering in Spain. It became a, what I'm talking about? It's like, the sciences, math, art, writing, everything, because the Catholics, the Moors, everyone was coming together and sharing knowledge and language and art. And it was almost like this cultural explosion of intelligence and sharing. And so I think to myself, oh my gosh, that's what could happen.
Well, and in fact, I would argue we have had that in the 20th century. What I worry about is that we may lose that. There's the fear of the other, the fear of the immigrant, the fear of people who are different. We'll shut down. I mean, we're losing research scientists right now.
I know.
And then the artists and others. For no good reason.
Yeah. I mean,
obviously, if there's somebody who's actively destroying society, whoever they are, they need to be restrained. That's how you get flourishing cultures that are diverse and one idea sparks another idea. I think of in the 11th century, the natural law theologians, they discovered Aristotle, and there's this wonderful and they also in the process discovered this, the whole natural law idea that everyone has a moral sense. Well, it's not, as a small step, one historian says, from the idea that you can discover the moral laws of the universe the moral order to discovering the natural laws of the universe, the natural order. And then you get the Enlightenment. You get, I mean, those are significant achievements when you allow that human reasoning, not always perfect, always sinful, always broken, always particular, no sinless traditions, all that. But it, when you have enough trust in it that you can welcome insights that are not your own and think about it and then respond creatively, I think that's I think there's an ideal of culture there that's the kind of place I want to live. That's vibrant, expressive. I'm challenged. I'm not sure everybody likes to be challenged, but I enjoy it.
You're seeing
it may be that I speak from a very privileged place where I can enjoy it. That's also the case.
Well, you are. I'm so glad. I'm so glad to have you on this podcast because I welcome those people. So thank you for sharing that. I just love hearing all your stories. They're kind of incredible. I'd love to ask the main question of the podcast, and then we'll start talking about what you do in life now and what you've shared of yourself and your work. But I would appreciate if you'd share one story or two stories, however many you feel called to, of something that you've either witnessed or experienced that you thought was magical, miraculous, or mysterious.
So I remember as a young pastor, I got asked to speak at Presbyterian revivals, which are like revivals, but are about everything's in decency and in order. and a series of sermons over a couple nights. And I was invited to speak at Providence Presbyterian Church. And a friend of mine who was the editor of the paper, local paper, drove me down. He was from that area down in the south side of Virginia. And he drove me down and we had dinner with everybody. The whole congregation gathered, all had dinner. I had spoken at a youth retreat the year before for the Presbytery, which is the local body of churches. And that's how they got my name. And so we had dinner. The clerk of session, a woman said, and then the clerk of session, the session is the group that governs the church. She said, "Are we ready to start?" I said, "I think we are." And she walks out. She says, "Boys, y'all come in." And so they're all standing around outside. They start walking in, and lightning struck the oak tree that they were under, blew out a window in the church. And it was this remarkable, like, and the tree lived. But it was wow. It was kind of a clear day. It wasn't, it was just a bizarre event. So everybody came in and we had the service and it was fine. And then after the service, my friend said, "I'm going to go see my brother. I've arranged for you to, if you don't mind, to ride with this family who he said, "This church hasn't had a pastor and their son just died. Maybe you could offer some pastoral care and I'll come by and pick you up later." So I get in the car and I'm talking with them. And, I said, I heard you've had some really tough year. And they talked about their son, Calvin, who had died, had been hit by a car on his birthday. They gave him a bicycle and he got hit by a car. And it's just, so we get to their house. We go inside. There is this picture. He was in my small group the year before. And he had talked with me about his spiritual life. And he had a girlfriend. And he was thinking of ministry. Yeah. So we all sat there and wept. And these things just lining up like crazy. Sorry. Anyway, we're driving home. Logan's driving me back, my friend, and says, "So how was it?" And I started trying to tell him the story. and you know, the of Providence Presbyterian Church. So there's a moment where it's like, Frederick Buechner says, you know, God needs to show up in your life if you believe in God. I don't know that I believe that everything, little thing that happens, I don't believe God killed Calvin. I think things happen in this life, but I do think God is a redeeming presence. And I saw it and was able to participate. And it was equipped to be a comfort at a time of deep sorrow.
Thank you for sharing that. I can't even imagine what a tragedy. And I was thinking while you were telling the story, what a comfort you must have been for that family during that gathering.
I felt like I was. I mean, obviously they have to tell you themselves about what they felt, but I felt like, we were able to talk about it and about things that nobody else, you know. He had been in my small group just a couple of weeks before. And I had a sense of what they'd lost.
Yeah. Yes. I worked for an elderly couple for about 14 years in Portland. And of course, over the years, became really quite close to them. And, her husband had passed away the year before. And I think they had been married for 60 years. And, you know, when Sam passed away, I think June kind of felt an incredible sense of loss, of course. And so, you know, she had an ailment that she decided not to get treated and very quickly was in a coma in the hospital. And one day I went to visit her and spend time with her, and her daughter and her granddaughter came in, and we just sat for a couple of hours, you know, in the same room, sharing stories about Sam and June. And the daughter said to me, "Oh my gosh, you know so much more about my parents than I did. I haven't heard some of these stories." And I said, "Well, I spent a lot of time with them. And, you know, I had lunch with Sam two or three times a week. And of course we would talk." And so I realized later, after I'd left, because both the daughter and the granddaughter were kind of just floored by everything that I had told them, that was part of my work with Sam and June, was being present to her daughter and her granddaughter at that time, right, and telling them all of these stories and sharing things that they had not heard. And that I saw the comfort it had brought them. And I realized, oh my goodness, this was always meant to be part of the service that I provided to the family, sharing these kind of incredible recollections that they hadn't heard. And so I'm thinking about you and showing up to Calvin's family's house, and how, you know, of course, your relationship with him was very different. And so you could provide a different lens on Calvin and who he was and how he was in the world, and what an incredible gift.
Yeah, it was kind of overwhelming at the time. Once, you know, when it really hit me in the drive home, and I was like, wow, I'm where I'm supposed to be. At least tonight. So.
That's a wrap on my conversation with Dr. Raymond. As you'll note in the episode show notes, there are lots of delicious links for you to follow. Please do so and avail yourself of this incredible human. I want to thank Dr. Raymond for coming on the show and sharing his incredible stories, as well as the work that he's doing in the world. There's no doubt he's making this world a better place and encouraging more understanding and compassion for everyone in our worlds. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you could do so, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating or a review on whichever platform you listen. They help people find this little labor of love of mine, so I'd appreciate it. And thanks a bunch. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Dr. Raymond. Sink into the flow or the mystery that's life. Understand when you're needed. Step up to the plate when you can share a story about someone that might heal someone else's heart. We're all here with certain gifts, everyone, and you never know when that opportunity is going to show up where you can bring beauty or a blessing to someone else. So be like Dr. Raymond and keep your eyes open and show up in ways that might heal other people's hearts.
Yeah, that, of course, you know, I do sense, I do have a sense of wonder about the world that, you know, you're talking about experiences of God. I have continual senses of wonder. It's one of the, I like to garden. It's one of the reasons I love to garden. It's just the wonder of it. I'm really getting into native plants, and I just love seeing, you know, there's nothing quite like a stand of Joe Pye weed covered in bumblebees. And it's kind of like they're all, and all these other different kinds of pollinating insects. I have no idea what they are, but there they are. They're all, it's like it's alive. It's almost like a coral reef.
Yeah.
Of this incredible amount of just diversity and so a sense of wonder. I do carry that and it's a gift to notice it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As a former beekeeper, I appreciate everything you just said. I've always thought pollinating insects have incredibly good taste, and you should actually pay attention to where they're going because they know where it's at. Thank you for sharing that. I would love to talk, you know, with the time we have left, I'd love to talk about the work that you're doing now. Would you like to describe it and talk about your book a little bit? I'd really appreciate that so much.
Well, you know, we've talked a little bit earlier about, you know, the struggles that we sense the country having. In 2019, I was invited to give a talk on the global status of democracy in America's kind of response to that, or not the church's response, excuse me, the church's response to that. And so I did a lot of reading about democracy and I began to realize that American democracy is ailing in some significant ways. And I kind of want at some of these questions go back to my doctoral work. Like, what if people lose the sense that people are chronically flawed? Will they uphold and be vigilant about upholding the separation of powers, for example? Or will they allow an executive to declare a war or not declare a war, but start a war? And will we be vigilant about upholding human rights and the rule of law if we don't believe that everyone has basic dignity, as we believe in the idea of the imago Dei, the idea of everybody bears the image of God? And I wondered about those questions when I was doing my doctoral work, and kind of set them aside. And then as I began to think about why people of faith, Christians particularly, should be thinking about supporting democracy, the book kind of took form. And so what I think has happened is there's been an erosion of democratic culture, and it takes, we've talked about some of the forms, effective polarization, but this culture has eroded, I think, in part because the mainline church has not imparted its values to its members. The decline of the church means that fewer people are holding those values. I think the church also finds it harder to, there's a book called The End of Empathy by John Compton. And, he says that the church is, there was a time when the church was able to, like, the Just and Durable Peace Conferences, as American Christians, we should take some responsibility kind of upholding a global order that is more peaceful than what we've had in World War I and World War II. And so that shaped the Bretton Woods, the Dumbarton Woods, but also shaped the public. So there was some understanding of it. And I had seen that we don't understand what we're doing in the world, why or our place or what we ought to be doing as a hegemonic power. And so it gets cast in all kinds of toxic ways. There's a messianism, like, oh, we're the savior of the world, or there's a, I don't know, it just, we're all bad. Those questions have been, that's what led me to be invited to the Global Mission Conference in Bangkok in 2019, which started this book. We don't understand why we have a democracy either. There are all kinds of, the rise in political violence is an issue of that. The fact that American democracy has not really been very functional for 30, 40 years. I mean, think about the healthcare crisis. This is not new.
Yeah.
It's not new. Think about, I think a lot of people don't think the economy works for them. In fact, it's worse than we used to be. What is the average age of buying a house is, what, 27, something like that? Now it's 40.
Yeah.
And it's such a greater percent of income. So a lot of people don't think the economy works for them. What higher education, so much more expensive. And it's gone up way faster than inflation for 40 years. And professors' salaries are flat since 1980. So it's not like the professors are getting rich. And yet it's like none of our institutions work. The criminal justice system, we incarcerate more people. It used to be about 20% of the world's prisoners are held in American jails. So we have 4% of the world's population. Something's wrong.
Yeah.
Something's wrong. And we know it's wrong. And so we don't trust each other. We don't trust our government. We don't trust our elites. We don't trust our leaders, and probably all for very good reason. But we've got to find a way to work together. But the partisanship's just tearing us apart.
It is.
So what I'm sensing is that that there needs to be a restoration of democratic culture, and that things like separation of powers rests upon, if you're going to be vigilant in upholding separation of powers, it's because you recognize people are broken, chronic sinners.
Yeah.
And that was Madison's take in Federalist 51. If men were angels, you wouldn't need government. And then the question becomes, you need a government that controls the people who aren't angels, and then you need the government to control itself. How does that happen? Because we don't have angels running the government. The idea that, so there's a bunch of these political ideas that developed ideas and practices and institutions that developed in light of the concepts of Western culture. Now, then the question becomes, well, and this is, I think, where the Christian nationalists want to say, well, we're a Christian nation. Well, the concepts themselves, they have a particular history, but you don't have to be a Christian to support democracy. Gosh, pagan Greeks had democracy. The democracy in Japan is arguably stronger than the one in America right now. I mean, so that's so that's clearly not the case, but it is the case that people need good reasons to do hard things, and those good reasons very often are religious reasons, And that's where the mainline church's failure to pass its vision on to others, not being effective, being in disarray, has contributed. It's not the only thing going on, but it has contributed to a decline in democratic culture. So I wrote a book called A Democratic and Republican Faith. The title comes from an observation made by Alexis de Tocqueville, who said that when he observed the success of American democracy, remember, he's right in the middle of the French Revolution. So he observes the success of American democracy. He says it's due to the democratic and republican faith of the people who colonized North America. And that is, the church has trained the habits and the inculcated virtues that people took into public life, and that tended to be democratic and republican. And one of the things is, you know, the idea of universal human dignity. You don't get human rights, you don't get universal franchise without some notions of universal human dignity. And Francis Fukuyama, in his book, The End of History, says liberalism spreading all over the world, but it can't account for human dignity. And right now, and he thinks that's a problem for the future. And I think we're seeing that he was right. We need to have some way. And so we see with people like with some of the immigrants, who the way they're treated, these are not animals.
Yeah.
Even if they were animals, we owe animals some dignity too.
Yeah.
If we believe there's a creator who made them and cares for them, whose eyes on the sparrow, we owe animals dignity.
Yeah.
But human beings in particular, and rounding them up and tasing them and, you know, taking them and leaving their children screaming in the car alone, locking people up, not giving people their medications so they die. Mm-hmm. These things are unconscionable.
Yeah.
And if we think that people are made in the image of God. And so I think I wrote my book to kind of talk about 9 principles and their kind of practical implications. I wrote it for ordinary people, not just for clergy. I wrote it to help the church kind of reclaim its voice. And because I think we've got something to say that we haven't been saying very well. And I do think also that that we've had this idea that the way we get to common ground is to go for the lowest common denominator, you know. But I don't think that I do think there's something to be said for we find common ground by going to higher ground, that we actually do share a sense that people have dignity. You know, we might not all come at it the same way. I'm coming at it as someone who thinks that people bear the image of God. Jewish people come at it that way. Muslims have different ways of talking about human dignity. Buddhists and others have ways of talking. You know, so we don't all have to talk about it the same way, but we do all need to affirm that. And so going to higher ground and then talking about what does it mean to say that everybody's got dignity? What does that mean practically for an immigration policy? And you're likely not to get everybody to agree about the immigration policy, right? I don't know that I'm wise enough to tell you exactly how to fix America's immigration system. But I do know that any system that would be acceptable to me is going to have to respect the humanity of immigrants, because it's you can't say there's a citizens have dignity and immigrants don't. That's just that doesn't fly in my faith. And I don't think it flies for most people.